Hey, wake up. New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, ugh, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams, whew,
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
Seven months.
You're having fun.
I don't know where you got this.
You're tired.
60 for a month.
Mine's 31.
Congratulations.
But it seems like a minute ago.
That's what everybody says.
Lord. That's because, you know, what happens now is the wheel turns. And the next group's coming up.
That's right.
That's what it is.
We're being retired.
You're very young. Greetings to my fellow thought forms drifting in the dreams of a slumbering god. May she rest forever, unless she doesn't want to anymore. It is I, D. Trussell, and you are listening to Node 7148-61921 in time frame Omega 617. If this is your first time listening, we welcome you and invite you to join us in lucidifying your sector of the eternal dream by waking with us and manifesting benevolent, novelty-inducing, transformative chaos events into your reality. Blow some minds for fun and pleasure.
Blow some minds for fun and pleasure. You can find the secret treasure hidden in the ice caps of your poor frozen heart. If your life's in the shitter, get off Twitter. If you're feeling alone, take your phone and shove it back in the demon's ass from whence it came. Shove your phone into the demon's ass. Tickle his balls while you head down the hall, out of the dilapidated shack that you once were. The demon will probably wanna come, so blow his mind. Don't just play with his bum. Tell him that you understand that you and he are one.
That was the last thing the owl-headed god boy sang to me before I woke up with my phone in my ass. It was set to vibrate and was ringing. I decided not to answer that call. That was a cover of Ass Dial by Tron Crips. You can find all of Tron Crips' great music at Spotify and wherever they're streaming music. Man, we got a great podcast for you today. David Nickturn, my meditation teacher, author, musician, and all-around genius, is here with us today. We're going to jump right into it, but first, some quick business. This episode of the DTFH has been supported by Squarespace. If you want to set your eyes on a beautiful Squarespace website, go no further than DuncanTrussell.com. Squarespace is what I use anytime I put a new episode of the DTFH out. And you don't just have to make a website for business. You could just make a website for fun or to be informative. For example, myfavoriteneighbors.com is available. So you could create a website where you rank your neighbors, and they're going to love that to see where they land in your ranking system. And then maybe you could leave little notes explaining why certain neighbors have moved down or moved up. It's a great way to bring fun to your community. Myfavoriteneighbor.com is available, and you can use Squarespace to build that beautiful website because Squarespace uses award-winning templates that you can mix and match. They have everything you need. If you want to send out mass mails to your mailing list, Squarespace does group mails. They also have shopping cart functionality. I know somebody who sells their socks online, folks. And from my favorite neighbors to sockcowboygals.com, these domain names are just waiting for you to grab them. Try Squarespace out. And when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/Duncan and use offer code Duncan to get 10% off your first order of a website or a domain. That's squarespace.com/Duncan and use offer code Duncan to get 10% off your first order of a website or a domain. Thank you, Squarespace. It's time for you to scrape those invisible demonic hell toads off the back of your chakra system by rinsing your brain in the sweet, non-fluoridated waters of the DTFH Patreon. If you head over to patreon.com/DTFH and sign up, you will get commercial-free episodes of the DTFH, one extra hour-long ramble every month, and access to our Discord servers, along with lots of other cool stuff. That's patreon.com/DTFH. Also, why not up-level your vibrational permutations by heading over to the shop at DuncanTrussell.com. It's time for you to resonate with your highest frequency. Let the fishing hook of enlightenment implant itself into you and reel yourself into your transfigured, ascended state by wearing DTFH t-shirts. That's DuncanTrussell.com. Just click on the shop. Today's guest was a student of an amazing Buddhist teacher named Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche. He's also a musician. He plays in Krishna Das's band. He's won Grammys, gold records, and his new book, Creativity, Spirituality, and Making a Buck, just hit the shelves. David Nickturn! David.
Duncan.
Welcome back to the DTFH.
Thank you so much.
Your new book, Creativity, Spirituality, and Making a Buck, which is fantastic, and which is bringing some wires together that technically you're not supposed to bring together. Mm-hmm. When, you know, if you just step over that line too much of selling whatever your fucking thing is.
But everybody's selling things anyhow.
Oh, yeah. That's right. But if you don't do it in the right way, in the sense that you don't like...
You have to deprecate it and deface it and kind of diminish
it. I don't know how you do it right. In fact, I think many people get really pissed off at when they find out that spiritual people are making money.
Have a wallet. Have credit cards.
They want you all to be photosynthetic.
Yeah.
Photosynthetic.
I had to think about that one for a minute.
Yeah. If you're not, then there's some sense of like some kind of corruption or something like that. And you know, when you hear about like the great spiritual gurus of the world and then you see their ticket price and you realize how much they're charging, or they have like little meet and greets, like Justin Bieber, I heard, I've seen videos of this poor kid, man. They put him in there and he has these meet and greets where parents are standing there, their Bieber obsessed daughter has paid $500 to stand with Bieber for like 2 seconds and weep. And then like a bodyguard grabs them and she's like, get out of here.
Yeah.
Don't touch him. It's the craziest thing to watch. But when you see that replicate itself in a spiritual.
It's sort of like Amma without the hug.
Yeah. That's right, man. And I think Amma doesn't charge.
He doesn't even give them a hug?
What's that?
Does he, Justin, not even give them a hug?
He can't.
Not allowed, right?
Yeah, yeah. There's no way. I can get in trouble for that stuff. Yeah. But what the this is one of the unspoken things, which is like, man, spirituality, that's its own thing. Art, creativity, that's its own thing.
Right.
But the moment you start making anything spiritual or creative with some intent.
Right.
To get rich.
Well, get rich. How about just livelihood?
A livelihood.
Yeah.
Even how dare you call yourself spiritual? How dare you call yourself an artist?
Yeah.
Who the fuck do you think you are?
Yeah.
This is the attitude out there in the world, it seems.
Well, now that's the one side.
Yeah. Right?
The other side is people coming from the world of commerce and business who say, how dare you get spiritual? How dare you apply a code of ethics? Oh, yeah. How dare you be mindful about what you're doing? Why would you even bring up that topic here? We're just making money here.
That's right. It's just business.
So there's two sides to this paradigm.
Yeah.
They've been separated for thousands of years, in my estimation. It goes back literally thousands of years. And the idea of integrating that into some kind of sane, holistic lifestyle is, it pops its head up every once in a while. But I'm trying to talk about it directly. And
you did a great job of
well,
it.
Well, thank you. That's sweet of you.
And the to me, using Buddhism as a framework for the conversation is paradoxical in the sense that it, at least paradoxical if you look at Buddhism from a certain perspective. So I want to talk about that perspective that I sort of started off with about Buddhism prior to working with you and reading about it and studying it, which is that there's this sort of emptiness.
The nothing. The
right?
void.
The void, yeah. This sort of neutral emptiness within which there's this phenomena that we... There's some phenomena. Hold on one second.
Ghost in the machine?
Yeah, weird. I don't even know where it came from.
That happened the last time we talked.
God, man, that's cool. Well, so this sort of like vision of the Buddha, the starving Buddha, the Buddhist monk sitting with a begging bowl.
Yes.
This general, Buddha in some scriptures, that what did he call people? Worldlings. And this, and he talks to the arhats or whatever.
Sure.
How do you say it?
Arhat.
And and these are the congregations of monks that are have shaved their head or wearing robes and have a tuned in or let go or.
Well, the notion of arhat is they've realized some degree of egolessness.
Yeah.
There's a marker there with sort of the level of individual liberation.
Yeah.
But it's trumped by the bodhisattva. By the Mahayana teachings, which say you have to give that up even and then dedicate all of it to the merit of all beings.
Wow, cool.
So that even the arhats, by the way, in the Heart Sutra, which is the famous sutra which the Mahayana is sort of proclaimed, they say that some of the arhats actually died of heart attacks on the spot when they heard this view because it meant they couldn't even hang out with their individual liberation. They couldn't sustain it or hold on to it in any way.
And it just killed them.
Well, you know, it's how much shock could you take to your sense of reality?
I don't know.
Before you jump out of that body.
I almost had that happen when the Roomba ran over our dog shit. That's about as much as I can stand as I'm coming into my living room and the Roomba's done some kind of horrific spiraling shit art.
Oh, God.
Now, the emptiness.
Yeah.
The letting go, all of this that is, especially the emptiness, which a lot of people think of as a black
hole.
Black hole. None of it, I don't, it seems to connect in any real way to investing in this world, growing roots into this world, producing a life in this world, because who gives a fuck, man? We're all just rivulets of sentient matter floating into the great void. What, you want to start a website? You're going to like, what are you going to do? You want to start making crochet shit for Etsy? Let go and die.
Yeah.
We're all drifting into nothingness.
Yes.
Go into the forest and forget.
Yeah.
I mean, that's an extreme version of it, but you know what I mean? That's the romantic ideal.
It's great to really like, you know, use the Buddhist teachings, actual Buddhist teachings, to correct the misrepresented Buddhist teachings, you know?
Right.
It's like, you know, you're talking about Arnold Schwarzenegger, and then he's in the room, you could ask him, you know what I mean?
Right.
Like, okay, so here's the non-rumor part about emptiness. It is not considered to be nihilistic in the sense that you're portraying it. There's not a nothing valence to it. It's a kind of potentiality that is not limited in any way. So it actually gives birth to everything. Mm. So it's that kind of, it's like a womb. And in Tantra, it becomes womb-like and it gives birth to all phenomena. But they're not distinguishable from the openness or the emptiness of that. So when you talk about emptiness, you should always say empty of what? That would be the right way to talk about it.
Hmm.
And it's empty of three things, right? It's empty of permanent existence. It's empty of independent existence, and it's empty of substantial singular existence. Now, if you can qualify something those three ways, you could say it's empty.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
So okay. Take Duncan, for example.
All right.
Are you permanent?
No.
Do you exist independently of all other phenomena?
Nope. Not yet.
And can you identify a singularity that is Duncan, that is reduced down to a singular phenomenon like a soul or a, you know, an Atman or something like that? Is there something you could identify as the singular Duncanness?
Well, it's kind of like tattoos, right? Like, that's why I don't get tattoos.
Well, that's right.
Because you get a tattoo and you could, when you think you figured it out, you know, and then down the line, you've got this awful fucking tattoo and you still have to explain to people what it is. It's like my poor friend who like tattooed the initials of his girlfriend on his ankle in high school.
Never got a date again after that, right?
Well, God, no. I mean, it didn't work out. Yeah. I mean, but then, and I have a friend who's a tattoo artist who says that's one of the signs that it's ending. If someone comes in and gets somebody else's tattoo, their name on them.
Right.
Because it's like a grasping situation. Right. Anyway, what I'm saying is any singular Duncan self that I have felt like, oh, that is it.
Right.
Has inevitably.
Right.
Over time proven to be just some kind of dreamlike state that I was in. And then you look back and you're like, holy shit.
Yeah.
I was going to do that. I was going to get a crucifix that said Resurgio underneath it, resurrection on like my arm when I was in college after I took acid and read the New Testament. Thank God I didn't. Thank God I don't want that tattoo. I mean, it's not as embarrassing as the people who get the angry clown or whatever, but it's still, it's an embarrassing tattoo. So
now here's something I noticed about Duncan phenomenon.
What?
You change your identity quite frequently.
Hmm.
Like you change your name online.
Oh, you mean my Twitter handle?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
You're a shapeshifter.
Well, I mean,
and even in you know, some of the work you do, you shapeshift.
I enjoy doing that. Yeah. It's a blast. Yeah, yeah, it's really fun to not be so solidified into some any given identity.
I mean, Duncan is more like a swarm of bees than an individual person in a way.
Isn't everyone like that? The Gurdjieff idea that we're just a swarm of various personalities living in the mansion of our self. And most people are running amok because the great master who's running the house has vanished, and that's your undisciplined state. That's what Gurdjieff says. It's really quite beautiful.
Fantastic.
So you begin to like, the joy is the beginning of the realization that the master is returning, which would be the moment that you start gaining some bit of internal harmony, a little bit of discipline, a little bit of consistency.
Yeah,
that's like the idea that you just got a letter saying, oh, I'm coming back, don't worry. Or the prodigal son would be the reverse of that, right? It's like you're the person out in the wilderness. Anyway, the point is, I'm a shapeshifter. Anyone's a shapeshifter. If you dream, you're a shapeshifter.
But I wonder about Gurdjieff. What did he do for a livelihood? Do we know?
He sold carpets.
Whoa.
Yeah. Carpets.
Yeah. So he's a little bit, I mentioned in the book, Charles Ives, you know, who was a famous composer, and he didn't want to have his creativity be his livelihood. So he sold insurance. I wonder if that's the case with Gurdjieff, that he didn't want to have to put that on the line as like, okay, I buy and sell teaching these people. So I'll sell carpets. And then did he charge students money for studying with him? Do you know?
I have no idea.
Yeah, it's interesting to contemplate, though.
I've heard cool stories about him selling carpets, though. Like, I read a story about how when he was selling carpets, he would assume a completely different identity and wouldn't be Gurdjieff the mystic. He would sometimes act really, like, dumb. He would act like he was sort of confused. He would act like he would just play games with his identity as the carpet seller. But I think that he knew what I think a lot of people forget, which is that every moment is holy and sacred, regardless if you're selling milkshakes or carpets or lectures or whatever it may be, that this is the...
This is it.
This is it.
This is it.
And it's okay to be any way that you are. It's that's okay, which is why this, to me, like a book that like dives right into this. And also not just in a woo-woo-y way, even though you have a chapter open that I do like that we've talked about before, the concept of joining heaven and earth. It's not just that. It's just a lot of good practical advice. And when we were talking at our, I don't know what you call it, the thing we do at Samarasa.
Dialogue.
Dialogue.
And that's what we call it.
You said, this is you learning from my mistakes, because you've been...
To be clear, yeah. This is me learning from my own mistakes and passing it on.
Yeah.
Yeah. I haven't learned anything from your mistakes yet.
You're gonna. It sounds so sinister. Oh, you're gonna, David. Yes, you are. Yeah.
No, but I mean, what is, you know, part of the concept in the book and in me working with people and talking to people is sharing the journey. And, you know, I think all of these traditions are passed on human being to human being. Any of them that are worth anything have a human chain of communication in it. So a big part of that is mishaps, you know, and finding out how not to do something. So I figure, you know, at my stage of life, I've had more mishaps than many of the people I hang out with just by longevity at this point. And it's things like as simple as, you know, if you're going to start a record company, don't finance it yourself and put both your houses up for mortgages, for second mortgages.
No one has houses anymore.
Yeah. but you know what I mean? Just some reasonable things that when we're in a fever of creative outbursts that we can misunderstand the situation and replace common sense with enthusiasm.
That's right.
Yep, right.
Yeah, easy to do that.
Oh, gosh, man. Everybody who's ever been in love has done that, right?
This is what I love. for sure. What I love about the Hare Krishna story, you know, and this is what I love about the story of Krishna, particularly the Rasa Lila, which is, you know, you hear this flute out in the woods and it's so beautiful that you leave your lanterns burning, you leave your baby, and you go out in the woods and you have sex with God. And then when you're having sex with the divine, who gives a fuck about whatever that old life was? It's like, you know, you wake up from a dream.
Yeah.
And you're not mourning over the whatever that used to be. You know, that past thing. And this idea is to me, when people finally have inspiration and finally sort of
light
merge
up, yeah.
or feel that, first you follow the flute, you have the idea. And then you have to have the guts to go and do it. And it does require some sacrifice. And then, divine contact at last. And then beauty is coming out of you. And you're like, this isn't even me. I don't know what this is. Uh-huh. And then you're hungry. And you're like, I got to fucking eat. I got to go somewhere to eat.
Right.
And I don't have enough money to eat. So, and if I can't eat, then I can't make stuff. And then you know what I'm talking about? This is the... to me...
Well, of course, that's a famous part of the Buddha story, right? That he was a hardcore meditator and he got down to one grain of rice a day, they say.
Yeah.
And real ascetic, you know, because a lot of the trajectory into the spiritual realm was based on asceticism.
Yeah.
That was one whole line of thinking.
Right.
If I shut it down, if I turn it off, if I eliminate distraction, then I will get to the, you know, some kind of experience of spirit.
Yes.
So he tried that because as far as I could tell, he was kind of like straight arrow, kind of industrious kind of practitioner. You know, if he had a teacher, he did what the teacher said, you know. But then it got to a certain point that he was literally passing out. Like, so not able to meditate.
That's the starving Buddha.
Yeah, statue. But then there's, and I've rendered this in some of my music on this topic, a maiden named Sujata was walking by and kind of singing this song, and she had like a kind of yogurt drink that she was selling, and she offered it to him, and then he drank it. And, you know, just thought, kind of, you know, what choice do I have here? But he found it kind of pleasing, and he also gave him strength to continue his practice. So that's supposedly the discovery of the middle way kind of approach.
Right.
Maybe you don't have to like be, you know, going, checking into the 7 greatest restaurants in LA one night a week and then, you know, being upset when your tortellini was a little bit overcooked. That could be one extreme. And the other extreme is starving yourself to death.
Right.
Maybe there's a middle way.
Right.
And that goes a long, long way into the depths of Buddhist teachings. Once you get past the renunciate stage of them, which really, if you stay with the renunciate aspect of Buddhism, it's very refining in a way. It's, you know, it's like you learn how to stop lying, stop cheating, stop abusing, like really behave well. But then it reaches a point where you begin to explore reality in a much more in-depth way. And that's part of the tradition, you know, all going all the way up to the highest tantras, in which really they're saying, this phenomenal world, just like you said, this is the sacred world. It's nowhere else. You cannot find it elsewhere. So that's a very, like right now, this is it.
The kingdom of heaven.
Well, if you want to call it that, you could just call it, they probably wouldn't give it that much of a weight-bearing load. Be more like suchness, as it is, ta-ta-ta. So in the book, I talk about as it is, what is it? And then the second sort of, metric is up to you. Like, this is up to you. This is not, there's no fate from a Buddhist point of view. Duncan is not fated. Duncan's future is completely open.
Yeah.
But primordially open.
Yeah. So it's like that as it is-ness, is that's where you start, the as it is.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a funny thing that people are saying is get back to what it is. So how much time do we spend with what it isn't? I guess you could say what it isn't is the fabricated part of the mind or the fantasy part or the part that is projecting reality in kind of a hyperactive way, instead of maybe pacing it a little differently and just seeing, you know, the actual texture and nature of things that you're working with, including going to the office in the morning, including making your cup of coffee, including raising your child.
Yeah.
So if you see those things as unholy, I feel you have a long journey ahead of you.
Right.
You know?
That's right. It's sort of like a fun exercise to just like scan through what you think is profane that you do. Like, you know what I mean? Throughout your day, what are the things you are doing where you're down on yourself and you're thinking, this is not who I'm supposed to be.
Yeah.
And for a lot of people, that's their job.
Yeah.
They are like, they do it. They feel out here in LA, some people who have a job that isn't in immediately getting paid for art, they feel really like failures. Like, I'm waiting tables. It really gets to people. And for some people who are making art and have temporarily sustained themselves, but are entering a place where it's not for that moment,
right,
they feel absolutely humiliated to go to work.
Yeah,
you know what I'm saying? So
sure.
To me, that's like a really interesting thing to start realizing you have zones.
Start with shame.
Shame.
Yeah, as the ground of your whole day.
Yeah.
Embarrassment, shame.
Yeah.
So this is one thing that Trungpa Rinpoche used to call negative negativity. I think you and I have talked about this occasionally, but the idea is you have the original klesha, the original confusion, but on top of that, you're dumping on yourself for having that.
Yeah.
And he said, you just strip that layer away first, you know, the kind of judgmental layer. Now you're working with what he used to call the manure of experience, like a fertilizer.
Yeah.
So all your ambition, your anger, your jealousy, these things are potentially fertile in that they can be viewed as energy. They can be viewed as a purer form that's not so egocentric. So, for example, you take something like, jealousy or competition. That could be like just a genuine, intense energy for excellence and perfection, which people have. So those things can kind of overlap on each other. But as long as you dump it on the whole thing, you won't get any of the juice. You know?
I want to talk about this with you. I know I haven't finished it. You recommended this fantastic book on alchemy started reading. And then from time to time, I'll just look up the Emerald Tablet, which is that alchemical text, which seems to have the concept of samsara and nirvana being intertwined inside of it. And then there's this invitation to take from any matter, internal or external, the impurities. And within that sliver of impurity, somewhere in there is the thing you're looking for.
Yes.
Which is a really intense thing that Krishnadas said to me once, which was like, he's always saying the most intensely profound things, but they're really compact.
Oh,
so once he said
nuggets,
to me, nuggets.
Yeah.
But he said, the longing is the grace. That to me sort of translates into some other ideas.
That's bhakti in a nutshell, don't you think?
I think
that's so. Devotional yogas have, the longing has something about it that pulls you forward and upward into the right You know how we would say this in our teachings, in some of the Buddhist teachings. There's this notion of raising what we call wind torus, your sort of personal presence and strength, and magnetizing drala energy. So the dralas are the self-existing sort of rich energies that are in the phenomenal world, particularly in nature, but not just in nature. But for you to connect with it, you have to kind of come up to the level of some kind of confidence and presence. Then they love you.
Yeah.
They shower you.
Yeah.
So, you know, this is what his tradition and my tradition have in common. Tantric Buddhism is devotion is really hugely important. And it's not so much, you know, it has a guru. It has a literally, you know, guru devotion's part of it. But it also has just that sense of longing as opening your heart.
Yeah.
And making you a little less, you know, kind of hyper-structured about who you think you are.
To bring it back to what we were talking about earlier, that if I bring the longing into the thisness, into the nowness, and it's just the longing, and then I'm experiencing it, it's those times when you're like weeping for your someone who's died. And in that breakdown, there's a moment where you realize it feels like I'm with them right now. Inside of inside of it is them, is the experience somehow of connection with them. And then if you take that and you look at the thing that you want, which you shouldn't be ashamed of. Some people are ashamed of it because it's so tremendous. And it hurts this thing that they want, you know, and they think they'll never have it, like true love or something. But when you look at the feeling of it, instead of running away from it, then somewhere in that feeling, that desire, want, right? There's a sliver of the thing you're looking for. Somehow it's already there, but it doesn't make sense because nothing's there to induce it. You know, there's the person or the job or whatever. And yet there it is in the sliver. You taught me this. The way that if you really look at pain, there's somehow it's not quite different from pleasure. If you take a cold shower, an ice cold shower, and really feel it, you realize it feels as good as the hot water. It's alive. It's like so anyway, to me, I think that there is a possibility for people to find that sliver.
Yeah.
And then manifest it, right?
Sure.
Into their world.
Well, that's exactly what is in this book. That's what I'm trying to get to. The notion of finding a vision, which is the heaven principle, that arises spontaneously and freely in your mind, like the unobstructed version of what you'd like to do in life.
Yeah.
That's called heaven, which is unobstructed.
Yeah.
Then as you draw that down to earth, it's always earth goes, but, no, I don't think so. What about this?
That's
what about
right.
that? So I say that some people will have a strong relationship to heaven. They're quite visionary, but they're not connected to earth solidly enough, so they can't manifest. But on the other hand, if you're connected to earth, but you've lost heaven, it's because you have this to-do list and you're checking it off and I did this, I did that, but you forgot why you're doing any of it.
Sure.
So there's no vision unifying it. So in the Asian paradigm, joining heaven and earth is the role of the human beings, us. And when we do that, we manifest, and we also manifest leadership, and we can also manifest almost anything you want at that point.
So heaven's like the Wi-Fi connection that downloads the system upgrade into your iPhone. And if your iPhone is not plugged in, is not taking the message, is not whatever it may be, then forget it, you're fucked. And then when you add to this situation a taboo on taking that inspired heaven and bringing it into the world in a relatively mundane way, if you think that that's not how it works, I'm a sellout if I start doing like actual like business calls and shit. Then you're doomed, right? Like that is such a taboo for a lot of people. They really think, my Uber driver was playing some music he made and it's really quite beautiful.
Yeah.
But he was telling me, I'm not good at the business stuff.
Yeah, a lot of people will say that.
Everyone says that.
But that's why there's 8 chapters in the book about business.
Right.
Like, you know, somebody could say, I love music, but I'm not good at learning how to play the guitar.
Right.
Well, okay, but there's a way, there's methods, you know. So the reason that I like business, and I have really enjoyed entrepreneurial energy and business my whole life, is because it's extremely creative, A, and B, it's like you have to be practical about things and you have to know how things work. So the idea that I can't engage that energy is probably a misperception, because it's actually part of living. You have to know how you're, you know, I use the image of a Phillips head screwdriver or a flathead screwdriver. You have to know the difference. Mm. If you want to unscrew something.
Right.
Right. So just some kind of practical wisdom. And, you know, mixed in with that is the notion of ethical conduct, which, you know, is sort of right livelihood. No matter what scale you're operating in, there's, in fact, I quoted you in that chapter, Duncan. You said, if you're lying, cheating, and stealing, it's not going to work out for you.
Right.
That was your quote. And yeah. It's great. It's because it's so to the point. You know, people think, oh, I can manipulate this energy. You know, yeah. I can manipulate this wealth.
Yeah.
And that's just, that's true, that you will create spiritual imbalance when you do that. That's no doubt about it.
Also, if you think about the mood state you have to be in to lie, cheat, and steal, that means you're afraid. Mm. That's just, you're scared as shit if you've gotten to that point. That's how, you know, when people start robbing banks or whatever, when people are like, you know, getting to crime, which is, you know, extreme dishonesty. Why are they doing it? They're not doing it because they're filled with some joy and love and feeling like the world is an abundant place. They're doing it because they're terrified that they're going to run out of money and they're pissed. And that attitude of fear, I think, when that gets in you, then whatever heaven is being channeled.
Yeah, heaven is unobstructed. There's no hope, no fear, and no hope. That's what's interesting about it. Trungpa Rinpoche used to tag hope and fear as a pair. Mm. You can't have one without the other.
That's cool.
So when he'd say, this situation's totally hopeless, and I mean that, you know, it's not a strategy to, how can I get hopeless so I could get enlightened? It is hopeless. And therefore, it's also fearless.
Yeah, right. Well, I mean, it's like when you get the thing that you wanted, the hope goes away. You will become hopeless in that sense. And, you know, that the moment, if let's say, for example, you're out there in the middle of the woods and you're hoping to God someone finds you because you've been wandering for like a week. You think you've seen like a mountain lion that's following you.
Oh.
And you're hoping beyond hope. And then someone comes and gets you.
Mm-hmm.
You're now hopeless.
Yeah.
That hope is gone. You've been alleviated of the burden of that hope.
Yeah.
And to me, hopelessness or fearlessness or heaven energy, when it comes through the pipes and there's fear in the pipes, it still comes out in the same way that if you like shove some cat turds into a water fountain, you're still gonna get some water, but no one's gonna want to drink it.
Yeah.
And it's gonna be disgusting.
Yeah.
And so that, to me, I've noticed when I make shit out of fear, when I've gotten really into like, oh my God, I gotta make this work.
Right.
It works. But within it there's the tonalities of fear. Whereas like if you do this insane thing, which I, from my very not long-term practice, I associate it with a concept of fundamental goodness or this general sense of like, my God, this place is wonderful right now.
Right.
This.
Yeah.
If I'm like making stuff from that place, which this guy Neville Goddard describes as working from the end.
Mm-hmm,
so working as though you already did achieve the thing you want with that state completely believing.
Yeah, a fruitional kind of point of view.
Yeah. Then good stuff comes out of me.
Sure.
You know? But where I get confused with that kind of manifestation stuff in Buddhism is sometimes it feels like there's a weird kind of like pushing or a visualization of a life where all my needs are met and the world is abundant and I see myself held in the great eternal rainbow field of love and my life is completely actualized right now. Where I get confused when it comes to Buddhism is it's like, well, Buddhism is, so thus far to me, is the practice of allowing things to be as they are. Mm. And that other thing, when you're doing your affirmations and stuff like that, sometimes there feels like there's exertion. Is there a way to bring these two together so that they don't seem...
This is exactly what we were talking about in the car on the way here, in a way.
Oh, cool.
So, you know, a bridge... Let's say, just for argument's sake, things are, like as you said, clear water, perfect the way they already are. Let's just say that. How come we don't perceive it that way? And that you also said, because there's cat turds in the water fountain.
Yeah.
What are they? They're our own habitual patterns and confusions that have accumulated over time. So nobody's denying that part of reality. That's called relative reality. And if you ignore that, the law of karma, the kind of sense of how did we get where we are, what energies are we working with, what confusions exist in the situation, what doubt, what hesitation. If we ignore that, we get a kind of theoretical version of the purity, an abstract version of it. We hold, and you can see it on the cover of yoga magazines, people with looking like they have an abstract version of the purity, but you know that as soon as the photo shoot's over, the shit is going right back to the fan and life continues on.
Right.
So on the flip side, if we can look at our actual life, and that's why I'm talking about like the real life that we have, and you see, there's certain kind of karma here. There's certain things I'm working with habitually, maybe doubt, maybe a depression, maybe anxiety. These things are recurring in my mind stream regularly. They may not be permanent, they may not be substantial, but they're recurring frequently. So then there's certain practices that are called purification, where you're actually cleaning the pipe, cleaning the delivery system. Of course, it's a relative thing because it's inherently, it's pure already. But relatively speaking, you know, we have attitudes, we have, we have things where, wish we could have done differently. We have regrets. We definitely have anxiety about the future. And these are kind of hyperactivity in the mind. So part of it is allowing the mind to settle down so that, you know, in a way you can purify by just allowing the mind to settle, right? You just feel the purity of it. But otherwise you can actually look through your shit, you know, and there's a lot of ways to do that. You know, the 12-step people have some of the best techniques for that I've ever seen. And they're not dissimilar from certain Buddhist techniques where you recognize what you've done wrong, you acknowledge it, you kind of attempt to rectify it and make a vow not to create the same trouble going forward. So that's purification.
This purification, what you just said, There's a concept that this guy Neville Goddard was talking about, which is really, really trippy, which is that it's called revision. You ever heard of this?
No.
Revision?
I never heard of Neville Goddard.
He's pretty intense, but you sort of, so you have the memory. We all have one, at least. Many, probably. Where the thing you did that you wish you hadn't, the regret memory. So that's the reoccurring thing. So you're sitting, and then this is one of the bubbles that floats up, the recurring habitual thought pattern. So Neville Goddard is saying, actually remember it differently, as though you did something perfect at that time, as though in that moment you apologized and instead of trying to be right, or at that moment you walked away instead of fighting somebody, or in that moment, whatever.
Visualize it that
you
way.
You visualize
the same event?
The same event.
Right.
But as though it happened in this beautiful way.
Oh, golly, man.
It is really trippy to do, and it sounds crazy. And he's not implying that this literally changes history.
Yeah.
But what it does do is it somehow leads to self-forgiveness somehow, because you see who you are now versus who you were then, and you let the who you are now be back then.
Yeah.
It's a pretty beautiful thing to do. But the other thing that it does, which I like, and to me, where this splits from my understanding of mindfulness, is that in mindfulness, it's more akin, as I understand it, to let's just watch the bubble.
Yeah.
There it is. And now it's gone.
Right.
Not let's look at it, time travel, revise, see it in a more perfect light, and then let it go.
You know, so this comes to a really deep topic of East meeting West, which is trauma. You know, and I really don't think after many decades of various Buddhist practices, but obviously mindfulness being the foundational one, I think mindfulness is a foundation practice to stabilize your attention. And it's really basic, you know. from there, I think then you get out the tools to work with your with your experience. And I don't think awareness itself, unless it is just stunningly complete, will remove the stains of trauma. So it might need other kinds of work.
Okay.
And even some people I know in our field, you know, would say that some forms of Western therapy might be more effective at that very deep kind of like stain of a traumatic experience. So I myself am just exploring these things. And I think there is a great phrase called spiritual bypassing that has been, John Wellwood, I think, came up with it, of the possibility of use of spiritual techniques to avoid sort of encountering some of these deeper rooted aspects of one's personal development. So we'll see how that shakes out. But I also think within the Buddhist tradition, there are many ways to work almost more shamanically, energetically with things. There's a whole map of the inner landscape of our, you know, our highways of energy going through the body, and the idea of opening those channels and purifying those, because really, what's ever stored has to be stored in either our physical body or our mind stream.
Right.
Where else would it exist? So you think, oh, I haven't thought about that for 5 minutes. Where was it?
Yeah.
It didn't really have much presence during that time.
Right.
But it recurs. So I think the idea of recurring is something that we have to address as part of practice. Mm-hmm. How do you deal with recurring? Oh, you can label the thinking and go back to your breath, and then it comes back. And then it also has a certain feeling tone to it when it comes back. You say, okay, I recognize that feeling tone. But at a certain point, it's like there's ways to get Brillo pads out and kind of clean out your psyche.
That's cool to know. Yeah, that's good to know. Well, that's just another
frustrations. 100,000 frustrations.
Prostrations?
Oh, yeah.
You mean like when you're like doing the thing where you're like going around the temple, bowing and stuff?
Yeah, but you dive all the way to the floor and you put your whole body on the floor 100,000 times.
100,000? How long does that take?
It takes people months or years.
There's no time for that.
Yeah.
I don't have time for prostrations.
Yeah, well,
I've got a family. I can't be flopping around some Buddhist fish on a temple floor hoping for peace.
There's no peace in it. It's really connecting with your emotional life in a different way.
That's it sounds cool. I would
you would love it, actually.
Prostrating?
Yeah, you would love it.
Oh, I sometimes
if you put it all right there. You
when
put
I
it all
get right really there. High on ketamine, I'll prostrate. Like if I'm tripping super, super, yeah. if I've taken the right amount of psychedelics.
Yeah.
Sometimes I feel so overwhelmingly in love with the universe that I'll do that just on its own.
Yeah.
It's also known as passing out. I mean, if somebody saw me, they'd be like, Jesus fucking Christ, he just passed out. Is he okay? Wake up.
Face down. Yeah.
But I know it. I love to hear that because this to me for a lot of people, Buddhism gets translated as a passive.
Oof.
Yeah. And
yeah.
I've been accused of passive hipster Buddhism.
Yeah.
Where, you know, and just this sort of like, you're not, there's no action there. And so to me, to bring it back to your wonderful book, it completely exercises that perception. And I think you've done a really good job of illuminating how there's action in this. There is an ability to interact with this place.
We call it entering the action.
Yeah.
Even when somebody leaves a 3-year retreat, the name of that gesture is called re-entering the action.
Cool.
So the retreat doesn't stand on its own. It's how you manifest after it.
Yeah.
So, and just to frame it out, I see three pathways for people like us. We become renunciates, monastics. What do you have to renounce? Probably pretty much most of the things that we do all day, every day.
Mm-hmm.
Sex, you renounce livelihood. You just
coffee.
Beg. Probably coffee, definitely alcohol, definitely drugs. And you pay attention all day long, every day, to every gesture, every word you say to bring it into alignment with your prime focus, which is to attain enlightenment. That's a legit, that's going to be a legitimate path forever.
Yeah.
Okay, that's one group. Now, the second group that arose were the lay people living outside the monastery who were receiving some teachings from those monastics and supporting them as part of a larger cultural initiative. This is worth supporting.
Yeah.
We value this. And so they're called patrons. And they somewhat have a household of practice. They do mantras and little things, and they have tchotchkes around the house, and they have a general sense of appreciation, the whole thing. So that's two paths. There's a third path. And that's the householder yogi or the hidden yogi. And this person, or even Mahasiddhas, you know, they look like normal people living in a normal way. And they're famous for that. They could be, you know, running a delicatessen. You wouldn't right. know. But the person has pure view all the way through. And every moment there is practice. So this is in all the traditions. In the Hindu tradition, you have this. Sufis, the Buddhists.
That's cool.
It's the hidden yogis.
Yeah.
And or householder yogis. And your view is the same as the monk.
Yeah.
Essentially, or the nun. It's that there is no wasted time. There's no wasted gesture. It's all to, you know, to move towards a recognized enlightenment. And yet at the same time, you don't have to change the outer form. You just change the inner form.
You know what I love about that? It makes it so there's no escape.
Yes.
It's like, yeah. you know, the fantasy. My God, the fantasy. You get it in college, maybe. But there is always a fantasy of like, shit, maybe one day I'll become a monk.
Sure.
But until then, I'm just going to be a fucking asshole. You know what I mean?
That's right. Yeah.
So because you've constructed a reality where, oh no, there's this thing I have to go to,
mm-hmm.
a temple, the place, the whatever.
Yeah.
But then to hear that.
Yeah.
And I'm saying it in a negative way. The positive version of it is that realization of like, right now, you can enter into something as potent as a monastic order.
Sure.
In your life, at this moment, you are in the monastery.
Sure.
It's whatever your surrounding phenomena is.
Yeah.
And then within that place, you can turn your life into something very instantly sacred and this and magical and beautiful and real, no matter what it is you're doing.
Yeah.
And that's a really intensely beautiful path, I think. And for a lot of people, I think that's liberating on its own because people really do feel like...
And it's a genuine path.
Yeah.
This is not wishful. Oh, well, I missed that boat, but this one, I'll make up another boat and sail off on this one. This is, you know, for many, many centuries, this kind of path is acknowledged with... But it's probably a little more inner, you know, a little more less show about it. And there could be delusion on either path. That's the thing.
Sure.
For example, if you're the patron, you could just go, well, I'm just going to keep making money and being, you know, running my, you know, my corrupt business or whatever, but I'm giving some of it to charity.
Sure.
Right. So there's a distortion there. The monks and the nuns could, as you say, be bypassing, you want to talk about bodhisattva activity? Try being a mother. You know, I mean, just look at being a mother.
Yeah.
Everything they say about bodhisattvas, mothers are already doing.
Right.
And that's why they use it as the metaphor for it.
Yeah.
There's no time off. You're just dedicating your life to the benefit of sentient beings, you know.
That's right.
And in the householder path, you could talk the talk and you have this kind of view of what you're doing, but it's really kind of flaky.
Right.
We see that. And that's why some Western people, they love Dzogchen and things like that. They're a very fruitional viewpoint because it feels like, oh, I don't have to do the prostrations. I don't have to do the hard work, you know?
Well, yeah, so there's always room for self-deception.
There's always room.
But
to the last second, there's room.
Always room.
Yeah.
It's very exciting to realize that, well, actually, you're in the abyss right now. You're in the abyss.
Yeah.
And you, whenever you're ready, you can be in that place. In I think that's one of the most spectacular exciting things because it's, you know, this is the resurrection of the dead. This is the potential that this whole life that you decided was mundane, profane, mediocre, lowered is in fact just as far out and mystical as some mountain monastery up in the snow. And you're the one deciding that it isn't that because you can't handle it, man. It's too much to have, as Trungpa Rinpoche says sometimes, the floor drop out. That moment of like, oh fuck, you mean here, my dirty fucking apartment with my ashtray filled with cigarette butts and my like dust covered fan. You know, when you're like not taking care of your apartment, your fan gets a thick coat of dust on the top of it. This place is it? this is it, as powerful as that. I don't think people want to deal with that because it's...
They want to say it.
They want to say it, yeah.
Power of now, be here now.
But if they don't, it's, but that is not really tenable for some people because it's such a shocking, it's a death. Wouldn't you say it would be a death, I guess? You have to give it all up. You have to like give up the fact that you're in a profane situation. All your attachment to being profane, all your attachment to quote failure, all your attachment to self-abuse, all your attachment to the cynicism that is, you think is your personality or your witty quality, all of it has to be, the moment you see it no longer as an aberration in the universe, but as a beautiful outflow of your heart and soul as you are right now into time, then you don't get to hate yourself anymore. It's an attachment, and that's a death. And then, because if a lot of people, that's the defining characteristic of who they are, is a general secret disdain for themselves.
Poverty mentality.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. So what are we going to do?
Well, I mean, I think it requires a kind of waking up from a daydream or a some way of continuing to wake up, you know?
First book, Awakening from the Day.
I know, I didn't mean to plug it. It came out of my head. It's sitting right there. Yeah. I'm not like trying to do some cheesy. I always feel like I sound like I'm doing a fucking telethon.
Right.
But it is like that. Yeah. And that's what you're so good at teaching to me and to your students, which I think is really quite beautiful, is this like sudden awe-filled moment where you're like, oh my God, I don't have to fucking move to Bhutan. Mm. I'm in Bhutan right now. Mm. This is it. And that, oh, I don't know how that applies to business necessarily, but.
Well, I was just thinking that, Duncan. Here's why I like business, particularly for people who are spiritually inclined. Because if you're spiritually inclined, you're usually working with, like Pema Chodron says, gentleness, precision, and letting go. She has a chapter called that. I went like, every beginning meditator, read that. Be gentle, be precise, and also some sense of letting go. The precision element is something that a lot of times people enter the spiritual arena, they'd like to slough that off a little bit. Right. Just shave that one off a little bit. It's kind of all one, or it's kind of all already good and stuff. So business just like does not tolerate that kind of imprecision.
No.
And it can be corrupt easily. And the motivation is what makes it corrupt. Like, you know, if there's greed involved, or if there's a kind of feeling of dominance, or those kind of, you know, toxic kind of emotional landscapes. But just the pure act of exchange requires a certain level of precision.
Right.
You know, like, even if you're just counting somebody's change, they gave you a dollar.
That's right.
Give them their change back.
Yeah.
You know, where's your mind?
Yeah.
Right then.
Right.
If you're thinking about a retreat right then, you give them the wrong change.
That's,
you know?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's in everything.
Yeah.
That precision.
Yeah.
And
but in business, it's valued. It's also kind of claustrophobic if you don't have it.
To me, the other sort of taboo about this, and we've talked about it a little bit more, is that you're not supposed to, I've always been taught, well, before I was working with you, don't meditate to get enlightened. Don't meditate to gain realization. Don't meditate for any reason. You read this all the time. It's really frustrating. Or you'll hear, certainly if you begin to experience some kind of like, well, like the famous Hare Krishna story, a woman said to Srila Prabhupada, when I'm chanting Hare Krishna, I see a light floating towards me. And his response was, keep chanting, it'll go away. You know, this idea of like, it's, there really, this isn't a thing that we do to produce some future thing. And then if you get caught up in that, you're going to get lost. And yet when I've been practicing regularly, for sure, inspiration comes. And more than that, synchronicities, and more than that, opportunities. And it's like my whole life lights up like some coal that's getting blown on. And I think when that's happening, when that starts happening, I start thinking, well, you're fucking up because you're getting good. This is not for that.
Yeah.
We're not doing magic.
Yeah.
We're not at a cauldron here.
Yeah.
We're not summoning this or that.
We're evaporating our beings in the great eternal nothingness. And then, you know what I mean? And then I feel bad about it. And but you know what I'm saying? So to me, it's really cool that you've written this book where it's not tiptoeing around the fact that if you start up a practice, weirdly, there seems to be a lot of stuff that happens that is abundant, where abundance starts appearing.
Yeah. And, you know, it's just first correcting the notion of what richness actually is. Mm. So, you know, you could say our whole culture is suffering from a misunderstanding about what wealth is.
Right.
So there's nowhere in any of these teachings I've seen that doesn't say our actual nature is not abundant and rich and potentially thriving. You know, that's, if people think you have to be punished and then what? Well, even then they say, okay, you could have some kind of brilliant retrieval from that. So the thing wants to end on an up note. It's like, it wants to end on an up note.
Cool.
So however you get there is fine with me. I'm really very open-minded at this point about what people do or don't do. But if you're a creative, which a lot of people are, or if you don't think you're a creative, but you're a secret closet creative, and if you think that there's some mitigating circumstance to just working with your mind in a day-to-day way to become more sane, more balanced, you know, use your intelligence in a creative way, in a positive way, which I'm just loosely calling spirituality, the mind aspect is spirituality, means mind, esprit, mind. And then if you have to live during a day, living in this real world, why can't that all be part of your journey? And why do we have to parse it out and kind of pit one against the other? So right. That's the view I'm presenting. It's what I was taught. I didn't make it up. It's the first seminar I ever went to was called Work, Sex, and Money by Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, Boston, 1970. First seminar, walked in off the street. Here's this high Tibetan Lama in a business suit talking about these ordinary things. And, you know, so it resonated with me. So I'm passing it along. That's really, and trying to make it accessible to people now. And then more, if you can give me the specifics of your situation, what I call the life puzzle, there's definitely ways to sort through it so that you can remove obstacles.
Right.
So that's maybe the Ganesh element or something like that. Look at the obstacles, not as obstacles, but as a way for you to learn more, to grow more, to thrive. So that's the particular journey we're on.
David Nickturn, thank you so much, sir.
Thank you, Duncan.
Creativity, Spirituality, Making a Buck. Check it out, guys. It's really, really good. And also Awakening from the Daydream. They're both fantastic. And links to them will be at DuncanTrussell.com. Thanks, David.
Thank you, Duncan.
Hare Krishna. That was David Nickturn. All the links you need to find David or his book will be at DuncanTrussell.com. Much thanks to Manscaped, Feels, and Squarespace for sponsoring this episode of the DTFH. Those offer codes will be located at DuncanTrussell.com. Thank you all so much for listening. I'll see you real soon. Hare Krishna.